First, let me remind you of coming events. It being the end of term, there's not much left. Tomorrow and the day after, in this room, we're having a workshop on reductionism and anti-reductionism in physics. Please feel free to come. Let me now turn to our speaker, and let me issue a warm welcome to him. He is, of course, Paolo Mancuso, who has done his undergraduate work in philosophy at Milan, and then a PhD at Stanford. His areas of interest are mathematical logic, history and philosophy of logic, and history and philosophy of mathematics, and he is, amongst other things, the author of Philosophy of Mathematics and Mathematical Practice in the 17th century. He has had numerous appointments across the globe, and if you'll bear with me, you'll see how this works. He started out in Milan, undergraduate, and then went to Stanford for graduate work. Then he was in Wolfson College at Oxford. Then he was at the Technical University of Berlin twice at different times, then at Yale, and then eventually settling at Berkeley. So you'll see the point that I'm making, and that is, in terms of the jet fuel that he personally has burnt, he's responsible for about half a degree of global warming, if the calculations are correct. He is presently Associate Professor of Philosophy and Chair of the Group in Logic and Methodology of Science at the University of California at Berkeley, and he will speak to us today on unification and explanation of a case study from real algebraic geometry.
Well, thank you very much. It's a real pleasure and honor to be here. So this talk is part of a continuing program on the analysis of the notion of explanation in mathematics. Usually when I speak on this topic, I spend a lot of time motivating the project and sort of defending it from immediate skeptical reactions, like, what explanation in mathematics, what's that? So I won't do that today, because what I want to present is more a contribution to that program, but I'm sure that in the question and answer period, there will be the possibility to discuss more general issues that not only relate to the paper, but to the topic in general and to the problem in general. So, this is a talk in a joint work with Johannes Hafner, who was a student of mine, did his PhD on something actually unrelated, on Putnam's paradox and Putnam's model theoretic argument in philosophy of logic, but we share an interest in explanation. And the strategy of the talk is divided into three parts. I will spend quite a bit of time talking about Kircher and his model of explanation. I hope to give you a good sense of sort of the details you need to appreciate what the case study is doing. Then I will describe this material from real algebraic geometry. It's not going to be very hard to grasp, and we don't need all the details. I think we get the general point, even without following all the details that we need to look at. And finally, I will say in which sense the case study I'm looking at is relevant to this project on explanation, and why it goes beyond the particulars of the Kircher model and the particulars of the case I'm looking at. So let's begin with Kircher's theory of explanation. Now, there are at the moment two theories of mathematical explanation on offer. The first one is due to Steiner, who published an article in 1978 called Mathematical Explanation. And that article has been extensively discussed by first by Resnick and Kushner in 87, and most recently by me and Hafner in another article we wrote together that just came out last year. Now, the second theory is due to Philip Kircher. Now, Kircher is a well-known defender of an account of scientific explanation as theoretical unification. Kircher sees as one of the virtues of his account that it can also be applied to explanation in mathematics. And unlike other theories of scientific explanation, whose central concepts, say causality or laws of nature, do not seem relevant to mathematics at all. Now, Kircher has not devoted any single article to mathematical explanation per se, and thus his position can only be gathered from what he says about mathematics in his major articles on scientific explanation. Now, in his later work, such as the article from 1989, Kircher uses unification as the overarching model for explanation both in science and mathematics. Says that, oh, this is actually the general picture sorry, of the talk, and then the outline of it. And then now let's go to the picture quote. The fact that the unification approach provides an account of explanation and explanatory asymmetries in mathematics stands to his credit. Now, unlike Steiner's model of mathematical explanation, Kircher's account of mathematical explanation has not been extensively discussed. A general discussion, now this is unlike the situation for philosophy of science, where of course Kircher's model of unification has been discussed at great length, but no one has really taken seriously on the mathematical explanation part. Now, so our aim is threefold. First, to present in outline Kircher's theory of explanation as unification, then to look at the particular case of mathematical explanation coming from algebra and geometry, and then we'll check Kircher's account of explanation against our case study. In doing this, we will heed, in fact, Kircher's advice given in an article from 1981, where he says that quite evidently I've only sketched an account of explanation. To provide precise analysis of the notions I've introduced, the basic approach to explanation offered here must be refined against concrete examples of scientific practice. What needs to be done is to look closely at the argument patterns favored by scientists and attempt to understand what characteristics they share. So this is also part of a more general project in which me and some of my colleagues, some of whom in fact are in this room, like Jeremy Abigat and Ken Manders and others, are looking at philosophy of mathematics with spatial emphasis on mathematical practice, so that in fact the philosophy of mathematics is also a reflection on the ongoing structure of mathematical practice. And explanation is just one of the things you can look at. There are many more things, understanding, visualization, diagrammatic reason, you name it, mathematical applications, physics, okay, so let's see now this account of explanation given by Kircher. I'm going to follow explanatory unification and causal structure, an article from 1989. Now, Kircher claims that behind the account of explanation given by Hempel's covering law model, the official model of explanation for logical positivism, there was an unofficial model which saw explanation as unification. What should one expect then from an account of explanation? Well, Kircher in 1981 points out two things. First, the theory of explanation should account for how science advances our understanding of the world. Secondly, it should help us in evaluating or arbitrating disputes in science. He claims that the covering law model fails on both counts, and he proposes that his unification account fares much better. What's the basic intuition of his model? Kircher found inspiration in Friedman's article of 1974 called Explanation and Scientific Understanding, where Friedman put forward the idea that understanding of the world is achieved by science by reducing the number of facts that we take as proof. This is the essence of scientific explanation, says Friedman. Science increases our understanding of the world by reducing the total number of independent phenomena that we have to accept as ultimate or given. A world with fewer independent phenomena is, other things equal, more comprehensible than one with more. Already Friedman had tried to make this intuition more precise by substituting for the notion of phenomena and laws linguistic descriptions of such. Kircher disagrees with the specific details of Friedman's proposal, but thinks that the general intuition is correct. So he modifies Friedman's proposal by emphasizing that what lies behind unification is the reduction of the number of argument patterns used in providing explanations, while being as comprehensive as possible in the number of phenomena explained. And forgive me for this long quote, but this will give us a very good sense of what he's up to. Understanding the phenomena is not simply a matter of reducing the fundamental incomprehensibilities, but of seeing connections. common patterns in what initially appeared to be different situations. Here they switch in conception from premise-conclusion pairs, typical of the Hempel model, to derivations, proves vital. Science advances our understanding of nature by showing us how to derive descriptions of many phenomena using the same patterns of derivation again and again. And in demonstrating this, it teaches us to reduce the number of types of facts that we have to accept as ultimate or good. So the criterion of unification I shall try to articulate will be based on the idea that EK is a set of derivation. EK is the explanatory store. I will be talking about that much more. Is a set of derivations that makes the best trade-off between minimizing the number of patterns of derivation employed and maximizing the number of conclusions generated. So I'll come back to this distinction between arguments and derivations and to the clarification of what the explanatory store over K is. But before I get there, a very important distinction, I think, really maps the alternatives in this kind of area. The distinction between local versus global notions of explanation. So in many accounts of explanation, including the Hempelian one, explanations are arguments. Arguments are identified with pairs of premises and conclusions and can be assessed individually with respect to explanatoriness. So I call it local because you don't have to go anywhere, right, on the global situation to decide whether an argument is in fact explanatory. All you need to know is what are the premises, what are the conclusions, do they stand in a certain relation? That's going to decide explanatoriness. Now, Teacher, instead, rejects both the identification of explanations as arguments conceived as pairs of premises conclusions and the local characterization of explanation. The informal idea is that explanations qualify as such because they belong to the best systematization of our knowledge. So that's a global constraint. You can't decide whether something is explanatory anymore just by looking at it locally. You have to see it in the context of the systematization. Moreover, explanations are not pairs of premises conclusions, as in Hempel, but rather derivations. On the systematization account, an argument is considered as a derivation, as a sequence of statements with status, as a premise or as following from previous members in accordance with some specified rules, is clearly specified. An ideal explanation does not simply list the premises, but shows how the premises yield the conclusion. So the derivation pattern that you're following is relevant. It's not just enough to have premises and conclusion without telling how you get from the premises to the conclusion. Okay, so let's look a bit at the formal details of the model. So we start with the set K. We start with a set K of beliefs, which are assumed to be consistent and deductively closed. And formally, one can think of this as a set of statements endorsed by an ideal scientific community at a specific moment in time. Of course, there's a lot of idealization, right? It's deductively closed and consistent, but let's go along with that. Now, a systematization of K, so we'll start with the first notion. It's just any set of arguments which derives some sentences in K from other sentences in K. And the explanatory store over K is going to be the best systematization of K. And I'm going to tell you how we get the best systematization of K, almost following a certain recipe that we need to follow. Now, Kitcher makes another idealization here by talking about the best systematization. It's not clear that there is ever a best systematization, but then again, there are various idealizations we need to make in order to get the problem moving. Now, corresponding to different systematizations, we have different degrees of unification. The highest degree of unification is that, as I said, given by the explanatory store over K. So what are the criteria for coming up with this systematization, which is going to be the best? Now, Kitcher lists three criteria for judging the quality of a systematization sigma. although only two of them will be relevant to our discussion. In order to introduce them, we need to clarify three notions. Argument patterns, generating set for sigma, and conclusion set for sigma. So, let's begin with an argument pattern. An argument pattern is something that Kitcher derives from specific examples taken from the natural sciences, in particular Newtonian mechanics and Darwin's theory of evolution. It is rather unfortunate that Kitcher actually does not spend enough time to truly work out the examples he's giving, because often it's not at all clear how the example he's appealing to actually match the sort of project he's defending. But what I'll do is to actually provide instances from mathematics, since we're talking about mathematics. So let's begin then with the notion of a schematic sentence. Okay, that's in the middle of the page. Now, a schematic sentence is an expression obtained by replacing some or all of the non-logical constants in a sentence by dummy letters. So if you have a specific predicate for whatever realm you're investigating, mass, energy, whatever, you simply pluck them out if you want, if you need to, and you'll have variables in places of those specific constants. Now, a schematic argument is simply a sequence of schematic sentences. Of course, in logic, you're used to do this, right, when you take a logical argument and you simply remove everywhere all the non-logical constants. All you're left with is the mere logical structure of the argument. But for Kitcher, that's not always what we're going to do. That's an extreme case. In many cases, you only want to replace some of the non-logical constants, not necessarily all. Now, a classification for a schematic argument is a set of sentences which tell us exactly what role each sentence in a schematic argument is playing. For instance, whether it is a premise, which sentences are inferred from which, and according to what rules. And finally, a general argument pattern, which I have here again, SFC, is a triple consisting of a schematic argument S, a set F of sets of filling instructions, and a classification C for S. Now, this all looks already complicated, so let's look at a very simple example that will give us an idea of just a very, very trivial thing, but you gotta start with the trivial stuff to get a good sense of what's going on. So, consider the problem of determining the equation to the tangent, to the line tangent, to the curve y equals 2x squared plus 3x plus 1 at point 1,6. That's a standard problem in the calculus. We can solve the problem using derivatives as follows. We take the derivative of the function, which is 4x plus 3. Then we're looking at point 1,6, so the x coordinate is 1. We replace that value, we get 7, and then the tangent line is given simply by the equation x minus 1 times 7 equals y minus 6. Okay, so let's see how we get the schematic argument out of this thing. Well, for instance, we could get a schematic argument for determining the tangent line to a differentiable curve f of x at point y0, x0. This is the schematic argument in the center. I'm now starting to number premises 1s, 2s for schematic, 3s. So we start by saying, well, that's the schematic argument obtained by replacing specific functions and putting in arbitrary functions for them, and replacing specific values and putting in arbitrary values. And then we have these filling instructions. The filling instructions simply say that, we have to replace f of x by a description of the function under consideration, replace g by a description of the derivative of f of x, replace c by the value of g of x at x0, and then the classification tells you how these premises operate, or how each one of those 1s, 2s, 3s operate. So 1s and 2s are premises, 3s follows from 1s and 2s by calculus, right? So notice the difference here between the way things are done in logic, where in fact the derivation would be completely spelled out. Here you can appeal to a lot of informal stuff. So you can say by calculus, or you could say by Newtonian mechanics, Or perhaps you could say by calculus in an example that deals with Newtonian mechanics. Okay, so this example was fashioned in exact analogy with the ones that Kircher gives for Newtonian mechanics, in fact. What he says on the difference between the purely logical patterns is the following. He says, whereas logicians are concerned to display all the schematic premises which are employed and to specify exactly which rules of the inference are used, our example allows for the use of premises, mathematical assumptions, which do not occur as terms of the schematic argument, and it does not give a complete description of the way in which the route from 1 to 2 to 3 is to go. Just as in our example, we don't specify how we use calculus to go to the conclusion from 1s and 2s. Okay, now having defined a notion of a general argument pattern, we now need to capture formally the notion of explanatory store over K, what he calls EK, which informally will turn out to be, and I quote again, the set of derivations that makes the best trade-off between minimizing the number of patterns of derivation employed and maximizing the number of conclusions generated. Now, a set of derivations is acceptable relative to the body of knowledge we started with, body of beliefs K, just in case every step in the derivation is deductively valid and each premise of each derivation belongs to K. So that's all right. We're moving within K. We're proving things about K from things in K using logical reasoning. The system was consistent to start. If the logic doesn't give trouble, we're going to end up with consistent systems and not a trouble. Now, a generating set for a set of derivations sigma is a set of argument patterns pi such that each derivation in the set sigma instantiates some pattern in the generating set pi. So think of the set of derivations sigma in the particular case as being all the examples I was giving of finding tangent to a specific point at a specific curve. That's going to be the sigma. Now, when we abstract and we get the general argument pattern, we get to pi. Okay? And so sigma simply instantiates the general argument pattern. Now, a generating set pi for sigma is complete with respect to K, if and only if every derivation which is acceptable relative to K and which instantiates a pattern in pi belongs to sigma. So this is just to say that the generating set pi is complete in that it manages to, in fact, produce all the specific instances that are instances in K of such reason. Okay, that's all we need. I'm sorry about these technicalities, but we need to get them straight to get what, you know, to get the picture. Now, informally, the determination of EK, the best explanatory store over K, will go through the following steps. First, we select, among all possible systematizations of K, only the acceptable systematization of K, i.e. those sets of derivations that are acceptable relative to K. Second, to each acceptable systematization selected in 1, we associate the collection of the generating sets for that systematization that are complete with respect to K. I'm going to make this more intuitive by going back to the calculus. Third, for each acceptable systematization, we now select a basis. Now, what's a basis? A basis is an element of the collection of the generating sets for that systematization which ranks best according to the criterion of paucity of patterns. Okay, so the basis minimizes the number of argument patterns you're really dealing with. Finally, we rank all bases of the acceptable systematizations according to their unifying power, And in order to do this, we need just the last thing, and then we're done with the technical details of this particular model. The thing is that the quality of the generating set is inversely proportional to the number of patterns it contains. But in order to make clear what the best unification is, we need to look also at how many consequences can we get out of this particular basis. So, so paucity, as it were, brings us up only to level 3, looking at the minimal amount. But we can't go just for the number. We need to get as many conclusions as possible. And that's the other part of the equation, so to speak. So in order to rank the basis in step 4, we need one more thing. Let's define the conclusion set of a set of arguments sigma, C of sigma, to be the set of sentences which occur as conclusions of some argument in sigma. Kitcher concludes by giving a qualitative assessment of the unifying power of a systematization sigma. Assuming that we can even give precise numerical values to the number of patterns, which is a big problem, in the basis and the size of sigma, then the degree of unification, so this is the sort of final slogan, the degree of unification of a systematization is directly proportional with the size of C sigma, the conclusion set, and inversely proportional to the number of patterns. Okay, so all of this machinery is sort of brought into action to make that a little bit more appealing and give it, in fact, you know, to allow us to work formally with specific pieces of sciences when we look at it. Okay, let me try to exemplify this because these notions are hard to take in, at least if it is the first time you're seeing them. If not, then you're familiar with them. It's no problem. But so let's think of the case I gave with the calculus, right? In that particular case, I had one problem I started with, right, which was drawing the tangent line to a point of a continuous curve. What I used as the pattern was the abstract argument I got immediately by looking at one example. Okay, but suppose I did something really silly. And I came up with two argument patterns, one that applied to continuous curves which were polynomials, and one to continuous curves which were not polynomials. Now I end up, in order to account for the same set of consequences, right, I've done something silly. I've got two argument patterns. I really don't need them, but it's just to bring up the point that you can have systematizations that, you know, very easily just go off the mark. So let's say that K now, K was the original body of beliefs, is just a set of true sentences of the calculus. And I don't care now how we formalize what the calculus is. Let's just say what's it, a good text on elementary calculus. So among such truths are that the tangent line passing through the curve that I gave, 2x squared plus 3x plus 1, at the point 1,6 is whatever equation I gave for the line. And of course I have another truth, which is that the tangent line passing through the curve x cubed at point 1,1 is, and I have another equation for the tangent line. Well, obviously we have an infinitude of such truths, which can be unified by the single argument pattern that I have given. For instance, each instance of the argument pattern gives rise to a derivation that is acceptable relative to the body of truths of the calculus, K. So in this particular case, we get away, right, if we are just looking at a specific problem, of course there will be many other problems in the calculus that will call for other argument patterns. And so it goes. So that's just to give you the basic idea about this things work. Obviously, the conclusion set, right, for the specific pattern I'm looking at is not going to give me all the truths of the calculus. It's just going to give me the specific ones related to drawing a tangent at the curve at the specific point. So, in this particular case, what you should expect for the calculus is that you're going to end up with lots of argument patterns, right? Each problem is going to call for one argument pattern. And that's already making it problematic in terms of measuring things by looking at paucity of patterns and the set of conclusions, because
both the patterns, at least prima facie, will be infinite, and the conclusions will be infinite. So now you're starting to measure things for which, you know, proportion theory wasn't really tailored to do. I mean, there are ways around it, and we can talk about that during the question and answer period, but in the face of it, it's a problem. Okay. How does Kircher's model fit concrete cases? In order to discuss the application of Kircher's model to concrete cases, it is important to gain an insight into the sort of examples that Kircher thinks his model can handle. The most extended discussion of such examples is given by Kircher in his book, The Nature of Mathematical Knowledge. In chapter 9, Patterns of Mathematical Change, one of the patterns discussed is, in fact, systematization. This discussion is important for our goals as it is presented by Kircher as an exemplification of the claims contained in his article, Explanatory Unification, which have been presented. Now, Kircher divides systematizations into two major groups, systematizations by axiomatization and systematizations by conceptualization. In the case of systematization by conceptualization, he mentions, for instance, the improvement obtained by Viet's algebra in treating systematically classes of equations of the same degree, say degree 3, in contraposition to the case-by-case analysis typical of Cardan's Ars Magnum. Similarly, Lagrange, through his analysis of resolvent equations and permutation of equations, represents a huge step forward in our understanding of why the solution of certain equations can be reduced to the solution of equations of lower degree. What he says then is that in both these cases, one adopts new language which allows for the replacement of a disparate set of questions and accepted solutions with a single form of question and a single pattern of reasoning, which subsume the prior questions and solutions. Generally, systematization by conceptualization consists in modifying the language to enable statements, questions, and reasonings, which were formerly treated separately, to be brought together under a common formulation. The new language enables us to perceive the common thread which runs through our old problem solutions, thereby increasing our insight into why those solutions work. This is especially apparent in the case of Lagrange, where antecedently there seems to be neither rhyme nor reason to the choice of substitutions, and thus a genuine explanatory problem. Now, the problem we would like to point out to you can be explained as follows. Kircher is very explicit about the fact that the new unification provided by Lagrange or Galois in the theory of equations must use a richer language. New concepts and new properties of these concepts. But where earlier on, if you look at the model, where earlier on we had to account for a set K of sentences formulated in the language LK, we now have a set K star of sentences formulated in the language LK star. In other words, conceptual revolution bring you outside the language you had originally, and you need to put the machinery of Galois theory into motion if you want to do work on the resolution of equations. You're not just dealing with your original language. There is much more that comes into play. So we would still like to say that we have a better explanation of K that is offered by the new systematization. It's the old problem, after all, that gets a new explanation. And we want to be able to say that. But Kircher's model seems to force us to compare only systematizations of K among each other. And such a systematization has to appeal to only sentences from K. Thus, in order to make Kircher's systems more adequate to the actual situation we face when making evaluative judgments of explanatoriness, we modify his model in such a way that the systematization of K can appeal to a class of sentences larger than K. Indeed, such a move receives also textual support from Kircher himself, who seems to have recognized such need in his 1989 article. So the new definition that we need, and I'll just flash them out, because they're not very substantial, they only allow for the possibility that we can, that in a systematization of K, the set of arguments which derive some sentences in K can be taken, the premise can be taken from K star, where K star is a consistent superset of K, possibly identical in some cases, and where K star can be rationally accepted by those who accept K. So this is the situation of someone who finds himself working in a solution of equations, moving from the Ruffini or the Lagrange work, going to the full algebraic treatment found in Galois. Now, a set of derivations then becomes acceptable relative to K. Just in case the conclusion belongs to K, every set of the derivations is acting with value. And each premise now belongs to K star. Again, we open up the set of premises with the same conditions of K star. Okay. The advantage of this modification, and to reiterate the point, is that it allows us to exploit Kircher's machinery in a variety of situations which are very common in mathematics and in science. So we finally move now to real algebraic geometry. Now, in his monograph on partially ordered rings from 1979, and semi-algebraic geometry, Granfield contrasts, the geometer Granfield contrasts different methods for proving theorems about real closed fields. I'll say more about what these objects are in due time. One of them relies on a decision procedure for a particular axiomatization of the theory of real closed fields. By this method, one can find elementary proofs of the theory of real closed fields in the language of that theory, at least in principle, since, as Bromfield remarks, it certainly might be very tedious, if not physically impossible, to work out the elementary proof. Another proof method consists of using a so-called transfer principle, which allows us to infer the truth of a sentence for all real closed fields from its being true in one real closed field, usually R, the real numbers. Despite the fact that the transfer principle is a very efficient tool, Branfield does not make any use of it, and is very clear about this, and this connects our talk of explanation to a real case of explanatory demand made by a mathematician. It says, in this book, we absolutely and unequivocally refuse to give proofs of the second type. Every result is proved uniformly for all real closed ground fields. Our philosophical objection to transcendental proofs is that they might logically prove a result, but they do not explain it, except for the special case of real numbers. Okay, so this opposition between proving and explaining is at the core of this general project on, well, it's not the only one, but it's one of the key oppositions at the core of this general project on mathematical explanation. What he means by transcendental is never spelled out. I think algebraic geometers have a really good sense of what they mean by it, but I think in general it's something that is in contraposition to algebraic techniques. So techniques that do not require a lot of machinery from analysis of a particular type, but it won't be relevant to what we have to discuss. Now, Branfield prefers a third proof method, which aims at giving what he calls non-transcendental proofs. Think of it as more algebraic, if you want, of purely algebraic results. This does not mean that he restricts himself to just elementary methods, right, the methods that you can use from real closed fields. He does use stronger tools, but it's crucial that they apply uniformly to all real closed fields. Okay, so here I want you to focus on this notion of uniformity, because it's funny that we're using an example, right, in a way, against Kircher's theory, who is very much in favor of unification. But now, the interesting thing that is going to come up is that uniformity, somehow, is much more than unification. And that's going to be shown by, I hope, and, you know, this subtle discussion by the example we have. It is also clear from the context that Branfield does not consider proofs obtained by applying the decision procedure for the real closed field as explanatory. Okay. And in fact, they are almost never carried out in practice because their length makes them unwieldy and unilluminated. So to illustrate Bramfield's point and subsequently confront Kircher's theories of explanation with it, we would like to give a short exposition of a single theorem, a very simple theorem, which is also mentioned by Bramfield, and various sketches of proof types that correspond to that theorem. Okay? So in order to do that, I need to introduce a couple of things about real algebraic geometry. So let's start with the definition of a real closed field. This is a field which admits a unique ordering such that every positive element has a square root and every polynomial of all degree has a root. That's the definition of a real closed field. And you've got the axioms here. The funny thing about the last axiom is that you're stating you need 2n plus 1 to state that every polynomial of all degree has a root. So that's why it appears in that particular form. And the theory of real closed field is just simply the deductive closure of the above axioms. Now, an important result about, I would call it RCF, about RCF, is that there is a decision procedure due to Tarski, very famous result, and Seidenberg, which says the following, that given any sentence phi in the first order language of RCF, there is an algorithm which outputs 1 if the sentence is, in fact, provable, and 0 if the sentence proves, in fact, the negation. The theory is, in fact, complete. So either you prove phi or you prove not phi. And in fact, this can be made algorithmic. You have an algorithm that simply outputs for you 1 if the sentence is a theorem, 0 if it's not. The decision procedure works uniformly. Come back to this notion of uniformity here. For every sentence phi in the language of RCF. Now, examples of real closed fields include the set of real numbers R and the set of real algebraic numbers R'. That's to say, the set of roots of some non-zero polynomial with rational coefficient. The set of the complex numbers is not a real closed field as it does not admit of an order. That's the reason for not. But there are lots of sets sitting between the complex numbers and the algebraic numbers, as Artin and Schreiber proved. There are lots of real closed fields in between. Now, for a real closed field R, we denote the ring of polynomials in n variables with coefficients from R by R x1, xn. Now, a subset of Rn is called semi-algebraic if it belongs to the smallest family of subset of Rn containing the sets of the following form. So here is how you generate the semi-algebraic set. Look at all the sets that can be given by the equation f of x greater than 0 for any f in the field of polynomials. Over x1, xn. And then, of course, you close under finite intersections, finite unions, and complements. So, first question we might want to ask is, what are the semi-algebraic sets on R? Well, semi-algebraic subsets of R are exactly the finite unions of points and open intervals. That's all they are. And the open intervals can be bounded or unbounded. Okay, well, let's take A and B, two semi-algebraic sets, and mapping from A to B semi-algebraic if the graph is in fact semi-algebraic in the appropriate n plus n space. It is clear that polynomials on semi-algebraic domains are semi-algebraic domains. So we have just closure properties here. We can also endow Rn with Euclidean topology coming from the ordering on R. And then we set the norm on a vector x1, xn. And we can look at the open balls on this. So the Euclidean topology on Rn is the topology for which open balls forms a basis of open subsets complements of open sets are closed, and polynomials are continuous with respect to the opinion of the collection. Okay, so the simple theorem and the three types of proofs that we need to bring home the point. Simple theorem says the following. A polynomial f x1 xn assumes a maximum value on any bounded closed semi-algebraic set in R. If you want, you can think from analysis, a continuous function on a closed interval attains its maximum. This is the analog for real closed fields. What kind of proofs can we give to this result? Well, the first one we can do is using the decision procedure for RCF. Because we can say the following. Within RCF, one thing I have to say at the outset, within RCF, this result cannot be proved in this general form. Because the statement itself cannot be formulated in the first order language. However, we can prove each instance, and that's not lost in content, because there are only denumerably many semi-algebraic sets. In other words, the sum of all the instances is in fact the general theorem. There is no more to it. There is no loss. If we had, of course, a general theorem that covered 2 to the LF naught cases, we'd be in trouble. But here, each single instance can be in fact proved. So, within RCF, the best we could do is to prove each instance. For instance, RCF proves that x to the cube has a maximum on the interval 0, 1. And for any interval you pick and any other semi-algebraic function you pick, you can prove that result. We could have arrived at this result by running the Tarski-Seidenberg decision procedure on those particular inputs and getting one as output. From there, it would be a mere mechanical task, if we wanted, to provide the explicit proof in RCF. And as I say, every single instance of the theorem could have been obtained in this way. No one does this. I mean, this, the length, of steps needed, it's unfeasible. And so, you find no geometer who would be willing to say that such proofs are illuminating in any way, because they're not even carried out, let alone thought of as being explanatory. Second type of proof, then. These are more interesting. The following proof strategy draws on transcendental methods, and this approach is based not so much on the Tarski-Seidenberg decision procedure, but rather on one of its consequences, namely that RCF is a complete theory. So what happens is that when you have a complete theory, right, all the modes are elementary equivalent with respect to the sentences in the first order language. So if you prove the truth of one of the sentences in just one of the modes, automatically you know that it's true in all the modes for that theory. This gives rise to the following transfer principle, very much used in modal theory. If a sentence by in the language of RCF can be shown to hold in one concrete real closed field, say the real numbers 4, then it must be true for any real closed field because of the completeness of RCF. Now, the theorem can, of course, be established for R by relying, among other things, on the Bolzano-Weierstrass theorem, i.e. every bounded sequence is a convergent subsequence, and the least upper bound principle. But these basic properties of R do not hold in general for real closed fields. For instance, they both fail for the field of algebraic numbers. However, once the theorem has been proved for R, by whatever means, transcendental, you choose it, you just have to establish that it's true on R, then you can conclude by appeal to the transfer principle that it holds for real closed fields in general. This is the kind of proof that Bramfield, right, was saying, I don't want to even touch that kind of proof. It's so unexplanatory that I don't want to even look at it. So what kind of proofs could one give that are difficult in this matter? Well, there are proofs that, as Bramfield said, work uniformly for all real closed fields, which doesn't mean that you are restricted to elementary methods. So here, and I'll just give the merest outline, I don't want to get into the details, Another way of establishing the theorem realizes that what the algebraic means, exploiting the fact that if R is a subset, is a closed and bounded same algebraic set, and G is a function from A into RP, a continuous semi-algebraic map, then G of A is also closed and bounded. So, since a polynomial fx1 xn is a continuous semi-algebraic mapping, I said that that was one thing that could be proven without much trouble, and we assume a closed and bounded semi-algebraic set S to be given, it follows that the image of S is also closed and bounded, and it's semi-algebraic. I haven't given a proof of this result. It's not too hard, but I don't want to waste too much time on the technical detail. But what is, as I said at the beginning, a semi-algebraic set? It's just given by certain easy unions of intervals, i.e. it is a finite union of points of closed and bounded intervals. Okay? And so f of x has a maximum because the it's bounded and it's closed, so there's got to be a maximum. So this is a third type of proof that works uniformly for real closed fields. There is no need to approve specific things about R that cannot be generalized in this context. Okay, so let me then get to the assessment of Kircher's model from the point of view of this particular case. The above three proof strategies exemplify different approaches to systematizing knowledge about real closed fields. More precisely, we will in the following be concerned with systematization of the theory RCF, where now RCF is the deductive closure of the axioms of a real closed field. That's the body we want to systematize. So to say, assume we are in that business, systematize that body of knowledge. Now, that's a consistent and deductively closed, in fact, complete set of elementary sentences true in any real closed field, or equivalently, they follow from the axioms of the real closed field. To be in line with Kircher's terminology, let's call this set K. As was pointed out above, systematizations of a consistent and deductively closed set of sentences S may have to go beyond S and draw on premises from S star a consistent superset of S. That's what necessitated a slight modification of Kircher's original model and the different systematizations connected with the above three proofs are in fact cases in point. Let's look at the first proof strategy. So what again would be here is, what does Kircher predict would be the most explanatory type of proof or systematization? We hope it will predict exactly what from mathematical practice is seen as the most explanatory type of argument. Well, the first proof strategy uses some meta-theoretical machinery in addition to K, the set of truths we are trying to systematize. In fact, the decision algorithm for sentences of K is not itself a theorem of that theory, but a statement in the meta-theory. So when we use it, we are appealing to an extra piece of mathematics. So let's call K star 1, 1 for the first type of proof, be K together with some meta-theory. We don't need to specify all the details. Enough so that the decision procedure is in there. Perhaps there will be more, maybe induction, to actually establish the main properties of the algorithm. Well, the systematization of K relative to K star 1 is given by a very simple argument pattern. And the very simple argument pattern is the one that says there's going to be a gigantic term, which is the uniform decision procedure. Okay, and I can write that as a function f. Okay, and then I'm going to plug in f, an arbitrary sentence of the theory of real closed fields. And so the pattern we need is, if f of phi for the sentence, equals 1, then infer phi. That's the pattern. That's a pretty unifying pattern. I mean, that's all you need in terms of pattern for a theory of that kind. Well, the second proof strategy employs, besides the transfer principle, transcendental methods, like the use of completeness and compactness, which hold for R, but not for real closed fields in general. So I'm assuming we're proceeding from we test the truth on R, we find this true on R, then we generalize to all real closed fields. Hence, in this case, the superset K star 2, right, includes some of the theory of the classical real numbers and a formulation of the Tarski-Seidenberg transfer principle, which is based on the completeness theorem for K. Right, so we need, in this meta-theory, both specific facts about the real numbers to establish the truth of that statement, and then we need the Tarski-Seidenberg transfer principle. But because this requires the use of model-theoretic concepts and methods in addition to syntactical ones, in order to talk about truth in certain real closed fields, notably the real numbers, the meta-theoretic part of K-star 2, it's more encompassing than the one for K-star 1. So there is much more than simply the decision procedure and, you know, establishing by induction some of the properties of the decision procedure. The third proof, type of proof, belongs to the systematization of K relative to a wider framework, K star 3, of real algebraic geometry. Brownfield stresses that K star 3, so the one he prefers, the uniform algebraic matrix, is not confined to elementary methods. I quote from Brownfield, he says, in fact, we use Dedekind cuts, total orders, and signed places, this is a technical concept of form, repeatedly. The point is that in the form we use these concepts, they apply uniformly to all real closed fields. One advantage to developing such techniques is precisely that one is not tied down to elementary sentences. So let me wrap up now. Now, we can ask, what is the best systematization of K in this particular case? If we can find a systematization that makes use of only one argument pattern to generate all of K, then any other systematization which uses a greater number of patterns should be inferior. At least that's what the model predicts. Well, it turns out then that the best systematization of K is the one provided by the decision procedure for RCF, because there is one single argument pattern we need to worry about. The uniformity of the procedure, and it is a uniform procedure, shows that we have in principle a single argument pattern which can be used to generate all of K, not just a part, all of it. Comparing this situation with those in which we try to prove arbitrary elementary sentences of K by means of proofs such as those given in 2 and 3, two other proofs, make it obvious that we can get by with just one pattern of argument. Consider proofs of type 3, the last one I have here. The specific argument used to determine the validity of the proposition asserting that the polynomial assumes a maximum on any arbitrary closed and bounded semi-algebraic set would be useless for deriving, say, the algebraic form of Brouwer fixed point theorem or any other type of problem in that particular area. You can't apply this particular argument pattern. You need another type of solution for another type of problem. So certainly, 2 and 3, right, will require more patterns than the first strategy. Similarly, for in the case of proofs of type 2, for in this case, we need to determine the truth of phi under consideration in R, in the real numbers. And only after the task has been accomplished can we appeal to the completeness of RCF. But the first task, the determination of the truth value of phi in R, is not a uniform process. It might require a lot of transcendental methods to establish the truth of that statement. Rather, we need, as pointed out with respect to case 3, different argument patterns for different classes of phi. In short, whereas with respect to the specific problem discussed on maximal polynomials, all three proof strategies give rise to a certain uniformity in the treatment of statements falling under that class of problems, only the strategy that relies on the Tarski-Seidenberg decision procedure can be extended to all of K in such a way that the single argument pattern suffices for the generation of all of K. Thus, Kircher's model of explanation ends up positing as the best systematization one which in practice does not enjoy the property of explanatoriness that Kircher's model would seem to bestow upon it. The conflict with mathematical practice emerges because Brownfield has different intuitions, and so do I, and favors as explanatory proofs of type 3 and rejects as non-explanatory proofs obtained by strategies 1 and 2. So this is going to be, that ends the talk. One thing you might want to try to do, and perhaps this is good for discussion, is, well, forget about the extreme case. Maybe we can test a model with respect to 2 and 3, right? If between 2 and 3, it managed to say that 3 is more explanatory than 2, then it would seem that at least we can square that intuition with the model. But if it's going to predict that, in fact, 2 is more explanatory than 3, then it's even more, you know, it's even more trouble for the model. Of course, all of this taken for granted, certain intuition about what's explanatory in this context. And I'm going to stop.
We'll follow our usual practice, refresh.